Well, in this part of Focus 580, we will be talking a little bit about the history of a game. Now, over time, there have been many times and places where games have been extremely popular. People have been obsessed with them. But then those games have passed away, and now no one plays them anymore. There is one game that I think probably has a special place if you think about how long it's been played continuously and how widely the game has been played. And that game is chess. We will talk this morning with the author of a book that is about the history of chess. The title of the book is The Immortal Game, and the subtitle is A History of Chess, or How 32 Carved Pieces on a Board Illuminated Our Understanding of War, Art, Science, and the Human Brain. Our guest is David Schenck. The book is just out, newly out from Doubleday. I'm sure you can find it in the bookstore. Also, the guest has said he's willing to give away some books if we can entice people to make a contribution, and that's very generous. We can talk about that as well. And let me tell you a little bit more about our guest, David Schenck. He's authored a number of books, including The Forgetting, which is a book about Alzheimer's disease, which helped to inspire a documentary that was produced and ran on PBS. He's also written the book Data Smog. He's contributed to National Geographic, Gourmet, Harper's, The New Yorker, NPR, and PBS. And he writes frequently on issues of health, aging, and technology. He also has been an advisor to the President's Council on Bioethics. He makes his home in New York. He's joining us by phone as we talk. Questions, comments are certainly welcome. The chess players out there can call in and talk with us. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers to call. So at any point here, if you'd like to be involved in the conversation, you can do that. David Schenck, hello.
Hi.
Thanks for talking with us.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Well, we certainly appreciate it. I think that what I said is true, that there is nothing else, you know, with a possible exception, I guess, of Go, which is an old game, maybe older than chess, but not as widely played. I'm not sure that there's anything else that can match chess for its longevity.
I think that's about right. Certainly Go is quite a bit older. Go is a very interesting game in and of itself. The distinction that chess has, besides being certainly one of the oldest games, and arguably the longest continuously played game, as you said in your introduction, is that chess also has infected every culture, every generation, every language that it's ever come across, which is to say just around the world, chess has gone and is still everywhere, which is just an extraordinary thing.
Yeah, and I think that also one of the interesting, one of the things I think that makes chess as appealing and separates it from other games is the fact that, and I think you mentioned in the book, is that it's not a game where chance plays a role. Another very old game that people are still playing is backgammon,
right.
For example. But
right.
There, you know, you throw a die. You toss the dice, and that determines what happens. With chess, if you win or lose, you can pretty much say, well, it was because of the way I played the game, and it was because the other person played a better game, and that's that.
That's that. Yeah, you do. The buck stops with you at chess. That's absolutely right. And I think I agree with you. That's a really important part of its allure. It also is an important part of its history, because at the time that chess was apparently being really invented, and it was probably invented over the course of many decades, if not a century or two, about 500 or 600 A.D. And we're talking about the region, kind of India, Persia, that kind of area. This was a time where mankind was struggling to really come to grips with this idea of fate and chance and control over its own destiny. And I think it's not an accident that chess was invented at that time. This was really just before the first real scientific renaissance, which happened during the Muslim Empire. And, one way to look at history, the last, say, 1,500 years of civilization, is that there's been this steady progress of humankind taking control of its own destiny, you know, of asserting more control through knowledge of where it's going. And that's not always a good thing, because we can put ourselves incredible peril. But chess really is an important part of that process, and also just kind of a great metaphor for that transition.
Mm. Well, it seems also that chess has always been a metaphor for war and politics.
So many things. It's been a metaphor for so many different things. It's really hard to believe until you actually start looking at the examples. But no, absolutely, it starts with war. It's a battle of these two armies that are on the board, so it's easy to kind of see that that's going on. It's also because of the pieces having all these different representational powers, we're really talking about really two little societies. And we're talking about, obviously, the king and the queen who are at the top, and all the way down to the pawn. And everyone knows that this is still a metaphor that for 1,500 years, if you can imagine, that writers and other cultural observers have used this metaphor of the pawn versus the king and queen and the knight and so forth as, you know, where you belong in society and what does that mean to how you relate to everyone else.
Maybe you could talk a little bit more about the origins of the game. At one point, I guess there is something that emerges that pretty much looks like chess as it is now played, although there have been, I guess, some refinements in how the pieces move. But that the game did, it is based on some older game that's similar and yet different.
Yes. Absolutely. We don't know exactly. There are a lot of missing facts about the origins of chess, and I dare say many of them will always be missing. But we do know a lot. We do know that there was a four-person game very similar to the game that we now play, but it had four different players and four different armies in India, and that was, I believe, around 400 or 500 A.D. And sometime in the century or two that followed, as that game moved to Persia, what's now modern-day Iran, it became a two-person game. And if you look at the records of that game, it's really astonishingly similar to the game that we play now. There was a king of sorts. There was a knight of sorts. There was actually a piece called the rook, and sitting where the rook now sits, that had exactly the same powers. The knight or horse had exactly the same powers. The pawn or foot soldier, as it was called then, had virtually the same moves as today's pawn does. So a very, very similar game. There were some key differences, key technical differences for, you know, people who are actually playing the game. But I could teach you the differences in, you know, 3 or 4 minutes, and we could start playing the old game on any board.
Mm-hmm. And I guess when the game went, I suppose no one knows precisely when this happened, but when the game went from Asia to Europe, in Europe, as it was played from different places, country to country, there were times when different countries essentially had different rules. So I don't know if it's exactly correct, but you know, there was an Italian chess, there was a German chess, there was a, where they had some little peculiarity in the way they played the game that was different from the way it was played someplace else.
That's right. That's right. And you're skipping over. So let me just quickly say that the intermediate period there is when the Muslims captured Persia, and for the next several hundred years, this was very much a game of the Muslim Empire, which many people know was really this great, fantastic, and quite large empire, which spread all through the Middle East and then into northern Africa and even into Europe. And they're really, the Muslims are the ones who brought chess into Europe eventually after a couple hundred years. So about 1,000 years ago is really when it entered Europe properly. And you're exactly right. It went everywhere, and it captured the imagination of apparently everyone who saw it. But everywhere it went, it had these little differences. People were kind of tinkering with it. And I think that's partly a function of how a lot of these people actually did not communicate with one another. So this was a much older transportation time and information traveling time. So it was, you could very much be in your culture and not have a lot of contact with outsiders. And what happened was, over the next several hundred years after that, there would be much more traveling and much more sharing of information, and gradually the game became standardized as we know it today.
Yeah, but I guess as I understand it, the Muslim version is essentially the way we play it today.
Very, very similar. It's what I just described. The ancient Persian game became the Muslim game, and very much the game we play today. There are a couple of differences. Some of them I mentioned. Some of them are, you don't want to get into every single difference, but really it's only a handful. The most prominent visual difference, this will interest people, I think, is that for the first several hundred years, the board was actually not checkered. It was monocolored. So it did have 64 squares, but all the squares were the same color. When you think about it, you could actually play today's game on a monocolored board. You don't actually need those black and white checkered squares. It just makes it a little handier to remember, visually where certain pieces can go and cannot go.
Our guest in this hour, Focus 580, David Schenk, is the author of a newly published book that looks at the history of chess. The title of his book is The Immortal Game, and it's published by Doubleday. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. We do have someone here to bring into the conversation in Urbana, line one.
Good morning.
Yes.
I wonder if I could ask you to move from the history of chess to the current situation. I haven't played tournament chess for several years, but I just noticed that Vladimir Kramnik, a U.S. player, had won a world championship, and I was wondering if you could discuss what has happened with world governing bodies and if it's been unified and if or are there other players claiming the world championship crown aside from Kramnik? Thanks very much.
This is a pretty complex situation, and I actually may get a couple of these details wrong, but you're right. There was just a world championship. I'm sure a lot of people listening read about it because there was a scandal that happened during the championship. The challenger, Topalov, actually accused Kramnik, who, by the way, was winning handily at this point, accused him of cheating, of going to the bathroom so many times that he must be pulling up some kind of tiny receiver, radio receiver, and getting some kind of instructions from his team when he went to the bathroom. By the way, everyone who knows Kramnik thinks that that was just nonsense, and it was probably a knowingly trumped-up charge to try to throw a psychological elbow at Kramnik, and it seemed to work because the match got a lot closer after everything kind of settled out. But in direct answer to your question, I don't believe there's anybody that's actually challenging Kramnik's right to call himself world champion now. There was, for a decade or two, there was a lot of dissension, and the world body that we know as FIDE, I believe, was split into two after one controversy or another. Generally speaking, the last several decades of chess on an international competitive level, while there's certainly lots of marvelous chess that goes on, the sport has not been well represented by the people who run these organizations. It's been rife with, believe it or not, corruption and just bad behavior. And most of the serious chess players that I know, and I don't count myself at all as a serious competitive chess player, by the way, but the ones that I know are just more or less embarrassed by how the sport has been run over the last several decades, and they're hoping that at some point we can spruce up its competitive image.
Well, one thing that we might say, and I don't want to insult anybody who's dedicated to playing chess, but that some of the most high-profile chess players are known for, shall we say, charitably eccentricity. There's some strange dudes who are in chess, and I don't know if that says something about the game or it says something about the people who are attracted to it.
It's certainly a curiosity, and I spent one chapter, one and only one chapter, looking at it because I thought it was an important subject, and I think it is fascinating. One does not want to be misled that that the game takes perfectly normal people and perfectly healthy emotional children and leads them down this dark path. I think the people who end up behaving quite irrationally, and there are a handful of interesting examples, most notably Bobby Fischer, unfortunately, who's really ended up still living and is really a not well individual. He's just really hobbled by a psychological handicap now. I think we can pretty safely say that people like that are starting out with some difficulties. They're not completely balanced psychologically, but there is something about the game and how if you come to it with some kind of imbalance and you spend all of this time, and this is a game that, for reasons we can go into if you want, is so complicated, it can really absorb you for a lifetime of concentration, and you could literally spend all of your waking moments concentrating on this game and trying to discover its beauty and its possibility, and really only touch the tip of the iceberg. So that kind of nearly endless challenge does tend to take some people who are not well balanced to begin with, and I think help push them over the edge.
Yeah. Well, certainly the thing, and I'm sure that the reason that the game appeals to so many people is it is very intellectually challenging, and unless two people set out to replay a game that they've already played, chances are you can play a lot of games of chess in your life and never play the same game twice.
That's accurate, and just also an incredible understatement, because I'm just going to throw the number out there. No one will believe it until you actually, you know, look at how this is documented. But we're talking about a game that, although it takes about 10 or 15 minutes to learn, and it's a fairly simple game to intuit and understand, the number of distinct possible chess games, believe it or not, is estimated to be 10 to the 120th power, which is something like the word trillion used together with itself, something like 13 or 14 times, way more than there are electrons in the universe or number of grains of sand on the earth or anything like that. It's really a nearly, for all intents and purposes, it's a nearly infinite game. And it can, as I said, it could occupy your whole life, and you'd still only touch the tip of the iceberg of possible chess games.
Yeah, I like that. I think you lay out some of the numbers in the book, and starting with the fact that the first person to move, and it's always whoever has the white pieces gets to go first.
Right.
The first person to move has, there are only 20 possible moves. So that guy can move one of these 20 moves. Then the other person, the person who has the black pieces, they get to go second. Well, they also have the same 20 moves. But once you get past that point, the possible positions that all the pieces would take, very quickly you get to these astronomical sort of numbers, so that by the time that each of the players has had three moves, the potential configurations for the board are up to 9 million. I think I have that right. Is that right?
I think that might be right. And then it gets into the billions.
And then, yes.
For people to realize if they're having trouble kind of imagining this from move to move is you need to start out, you have those 20 possible moves at the beginning, and as you said, black has the same possible 20 replies. But just in that first move, what that means is that there are 400 possible board configurations. Because 20 times 20 is 400. So even in that first move, while you only have, you know, a relative handful of choices, the number of possible games and ways you could start is already starting at 400. And what happens is, of course, you multiply that by the possibilities of the next one and the next one, and it just very, very quickly becomes astronomical.
Yeah. And I know it to be true because you say it. It seems kind of hard to believe, but that because of the fact that it's a chance who gets what color pieces. So whoever ends up with the white pieces and gets to take the first move, apparently at very high levels of competitive chess, that does actually give you an advantage, being able to make the move the first piece. And you would think, how could that? But it does.
Certainly, you know, there are very competitive games where black wins. It's not like it's not unheard of at all. But it's somewhat similar to, if you imagine, you know, watching a high level game of tennis on Wimbledon or something, where the person who serve, it's usually his or her game to lose. He's got the advantage, and that's really very analogous to chess. Because you're getting that first move, you're always actually going to have this slight edge. Although it may be sometimes very hard to see. You are going to have this edge, and so I think it's healthy to kind of play to change colors a lot and have the experience of playing black and also have the experience of playing white. Yeah.
We are talking this morning with David Schenck about his book, The Immortal Game, and we will continue to do that here. We also need to take a moment to encourage people to call in and make a contribution to this radio station. We're now in the last day of our fund drive, and he has just spontaneously here offered to help us out, and that's a good thing to do, to offer 5 copies of the book. So, David, I think what we're going to do is here, what we decided we would say to the first 5 people who call in and make a pledge, with our thanks, we'll send them a copy of The Immortal Game.
Sounds great. And if Sounds we can work right. out the logistics, I'll be happy to sign them.
All right. Great. Very good. You can get a signed copy. And I think it's also fair that I think we maybe should say, maybe we should ask for people to do a pledge at the basic level, at least, which is $40. I was just so someone doesn't call and say, okay, I'll give you $1 to get out. That would be kind of...
I hope the book is worth a little bit more than that.
Well, yeah. I must say, you know, I've played the game. I know how the pieces move, but I am not a chess player, and I thought the book is really very, very interesting. So I would encourage people who might say, well, what do I care about chess? Huh? Wait. It's a very interesting book. I think you would enjoy it.
I wrote the book very much for people who, I mean, if you really know that you hate chess and have no interest in it, obviously this book is not for you. But it's really written very much for people who are, who have, you know, some kind of casual interest in the game or think they might be interested or want to understand why their spouse, you know, plays it so much. And it's really a very accessible book. You don't have to have any prior chess knowledge at all. And I think it's, you know, just as interesting as a piece of history, you know, just kind of as an illumination of what human civilization has gone through in the last 1,500 years or so.
Very much. Let's also check in real quick here with Dave Teal, our program director for WILO-TV. He is in Pledge Central where the people are there waiting to take the call. Dave?
Yeah, and we're getting some action here at the phone, so I'm thinking that may be people interested in the book. And again, we have 5 copies and 5 only to give away to the first 5 callers who are supporting AM at least the basic membership level of $40. And we really want to encourage you to do that. We've heard from so far 1,092 pledges. This is the final day of our drive here, so we want to keep things moving along, because right now we're at $151,339 toward an overall goal of $175,000. We've got a lot of work to do. Now, I see several phones active right now. Looks like 3 of them are active, so we may have a couple of books left, but, you know, again, it's first come, first serve, so, you know. Call now, but you know. Also, don't be disappointed if you hesitate, you're going to miss out. 244-9455.
All right, thank you very much, Dave. We will get back to you in a little bit. We're already halfway through the bottom of the hour, halfway through the show, talking with David Schenck. His new book is The Immortal Game: A History of Chess. It's published by Doubleday. He's authored a number of books, including The Forgetting, which is about Alzheimer's disease, and also Data Smog. He's contributed to various publications, National Geographic, Gourmet, Harper's, The New Yorker, also to NPR and PBS. And he's joining us this morning by phone. Questions are welcome, and we have someone again here to bring into the conversation. Questions are welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll free 800-222-9455. And let's talk with a caller here in Kankakee on our line 4. Hello.
Could the guest discuss modern variants of chess, particularly multiplayer variants, chess-like games, and also internet chess? Thank you.
Okay.
Sure. The game, you know, if we talk about chess as being about 1,500 years old, it's safe to say there are 1,500 years of people trying to improve upon the game, and from its very earliest days. And, you know, the only difference is that at some point, as I said a few minutes ago, at some point it actually kind of got set in stone for a number of different social and maybe even political reasons. And that's about 500 years ago that, you know, the game that we play almost exactly now is really kind of got set and started to become standardized around the world. But that doesn't mean that people who, you know, the people who want to improve it just went away. There always have been people to make suggestions. There was, a famous episode on Star Trek where they played three-dimensional chess, which is something that some people want to play. I personally don't know why you'd want to make the game more complicated, but some people get into that, and there are actually some people who like to play some of the very oldest, more ancient forms of the game as a part of connecting with history. So you can go on. It's one of the beauties of the Internet is you can go on and you can find, you know, groups of people who are interested in the exact same thing you are, and I'm sure that you could find any variant of chess you want online. And since you also mentioned more generally the idea of Internet chess, it's really amazing, how easy it is to go online through my site, theimmortalgame.com, or any of many different sites, and you can actually play chess almost instantly with a live human being who's sitting somewhere else, and they're just as likely to be in, you know, halfway across the world as they are in your or another American city. So it's really one of the exciting things about the modern game, I think, to just kind of, you know, say, you know, I've got 15, 20 minutes. I want to take myself away from my work or life for a few minutes and go play. And you end up playing with, you know, someone in India or Kazakhstan or something like that.
Of course, that's in a way that's not new. People used to play correspondence chess. They just had to use the mail, so the time between the moves took a little bit longer. Now that you can actually do that in real time. But people have done that for a very long time.
That's absolutely true. Correspondence chess has been alive for several centuries at least. And there's some great stories there. You can actually even play the slow way. So you could actually mail your moves now, or if you go online, again, not to plug my site too many times, but there's two ways to play. If you go on theimmortalgame.com, you can play a live game of chess, you know, say in 15 minutes time or whatever, or you can get hooked up with someone, and you will play kind of an email correspondence chess, where over the course of several days or several weeks, you know, roughly at the speed of a move or two per day, you can kind of trade moves, and there's this automatic kind of update system.
One of the things that you write about, I think, is interesting, is that sort of going hand in hand with how popular the game became and how fast it spread and how it went from one place to another and people found it and thought it was really wonderful, that there have been many attempts over time by governments to ban the game.
Yes, authorities just have not been comfortable with this game. A lot of the times it had to do with the fact that people used to gamble around chess, and that doesn't seem to happen much anymore for whatever reason, but that used to be a thing, and that used to be very threatening to particularly to religious authorities. But I think also it just had to do with the power of the game. People would see, you know, that this game would sweep into a community, and suddenly some of the best and brightest minds were just consumed with it, and the people who like to think that they were in charge of what people should be doing and thinking, spending their time, that was kind of inherently threatening to them. There was also a vigorous debate going on in the Muslim Empire just as it was being formed, and chess was right there at the beginning, about whether this game should be legal, whether it was against Muslim law, and it was really kind of very vigorous, and there were people who were descendants, direct descendants of Muhammad, who were against it, and there were direct descendants who were for it. And I think that the ones who were for it ended up winning out. They had good arguments, but I think mostly it was because it just so quickly became so popular.
Mm-hmm. I understand that there's some history of chess in your family. Your great-great-grandfather was a chess master?
He was. This is one of the things that I was really curious about, and I really didn't know much about him before I started research on the book, but I'd heard these legends that I was connected to this great player of yore, and it turns out there was this guy, Samuel Rosenthal, who was my great-great-grandfather, who really dominated chess in France for several decades in the late 19th century. He was a Polish emigrant. Came from Poland to France, and almost as soon as he got there, this little guy, this very, very small guy, went to the Café de la Régence, which was kind of the center of chess, not only in France, but really one of the centers of chess in the world, and just started just blowing people away, and was clearly one of the top 10 or 15 players in the world for quite a long time. Never really came close to being world champion or anything like that, but was certainly included in all the top tournaments.
Yeah. You also write in the book that when you were a kid, you didn't play, and that you really didn't start playing the game until you got into high school. And even then, you played some, but it wasn't until, I guess, relatively recently that you, in a way, came back to it and got interested in it again.
Yeah, I'm really writing this book as a chess outsider. This is not someone who's spent a lifetime playing chess. I've always been intrigued by the game, but I never really got completely sucked into it until a couple years ago, and that was really at least as much because of the history that I started to learn about it as the game itself. But I certainly do find it a fascinating game. The barrier for me is that I just don't have the patience, and I'm sure this will resonate with a lot of people. I don't have the patience to study it, so I'm limited in terms of how truly good I can become at the game because I don't have the patience to study the openings and all the different tactics and strategies that you absolutely need to do if you have any hope of becoming a truly good player.
Mm-hmm. We have someone else here to talk with in Urbana. Let's do that. Line one. Hello.
Ah, good morning. Mm-hmm. A Rosenthal descendant, eh? whatever happened to the reform of the game by Capablanca and Alekhine, where we had we added 10 squares rather than 8 to the game, and we had a combination of the knight and the bishop next to the queens, and then the bishop, and then the knight. And I'll let you go on that.
Sure.
It
didn't take off. I mean, the idea of a 10-square by 10-square board was actually many, many hundreds of years old. I don't know if that exact variation was novel. The caller just mentioned two great champions. In fact, each world champions in the early and mid 20th century. So this is 50, 60 years ago. They say that Capablanca was, the legend has it that he was the best natural chess player. That is, the best person to come to the game really, supposedly without studying much in the history. Although I think that might start to fall away the more you learn about his life. But it goes back to my earlier point. There are lots of people that want to throw in variations, and it's always fun to do that. But part of the marvel of the game as we know it now, and really part of the marvel of the game is going back many, many centuries, is that it's a game that does cross cultures, generations, age groups, language barriers. You can go online or sit down at a board with someone who doesn't know, you've never met before, doesn't speak your language, and there is this common set of rules. And I think that's one of the great attractions to chess, particularly in this modern age where you can communicate with anyone in any part of the world instantaneously.
Well, and I also find myself going back to your comment about the three-dimensional chess. That is, what, you mean regular chess is not hard enough for you? you want to add more pieces? You want to add more squares? You would like to have 15 quadrillion possibilities for moves? That's what it takes to turn you on?
Right. Almost every appearance I've done, and since the book came out about 6 weeks ago, I've gone to a bunch of bookstores, and I think at every single bookstore, maybe except for one, someone has asked about this Star Trek version of 3D chess, and I wish I'd done more research on it, but it somehow does capture the imagination of people who maybe get a little bored with the two-dimensional game.
Mm-hmm. One thing I want to make sure that we talk about here is computers and chess.
Yeah.
Because I think some people thought that it was quite the thing when someone developed a computer program that not only could just play the game, but that was smart enough so that it could actually beat a human being.
Yeah, I mean, this is such a rich subject, and it could easily be a book in of itself. One of the things I did not realize at all when I started this was how inextricably intertwined the recent history of chess is with the history of computers. It's really, for those people who know a little bit about the history of computing and where it started and who kind of had the first ideas in computing, that eventually led to the machines we have now, all those people were chess players, and really they used chess as this template for what a machine might be able to do someday. They used chess as this model of quote-unquote intelligent thought. And so even going back to Alan Turing, who's clearly one of the fathers of computing, he was this obsessive chess player. All of his colleagues loved chess. And Turing himself wrote one of the first, if not the first, chess software program. So this is now going back several decades. But as most of the world knows, probably everyone in the world, in the late 90s, they finally did invent a machine that came to be called Deep Blue, because it was ended up being sponsored by IBM, although really the substance of the program was in existence before IBM came on board, that eventually did beat, in its rematch with Garry Kasparov, then the world champion, it did beat him. I can't say that Kasparov behaved all that well, learning that he was about to lose, but the computer had a lot of dignity and didn't gloat.
Didn't knock over the pieces or anything.
Right. It didn't stand up and throw one of the pieces down and do a little dance. So I have to say that the people behind the machine, more importantly, the numerous programmers who were involved, and obviously any machine is always going to be a product of the people, behind the machine. Really, I just have a huge amount of respect for them and all the hard work they put into it and all the humility they had in making this machine better and better.
Well, I suppose that one of the reactions to this idea that someone finally made a computer that could beat a human, one of the reactions would be, well, you certainly should be able to build a computer that would beat a human because of the ability of the machine to make many computations in a short period of time.
Yeah.
It ought to be able that, the machine ought to be able to, in the blink of an eye, consider your opponent makes one move. In the blink of an eye, the machine ought to be able to consider all its possible responses and all that person's possible responses, the counters, and then, and actually play out a few games in the time it would take you to snap your fingers. And
yeah.
So the computer should be able to win.
Yeah, and that's certainly the way I would have thought about it before I started to look at the data. And it just turns out that, as we talked about earlier, the game itself just has so many possibilities that even computers as we understand them today, which, we think of them as these absolute marvels of speed and raw crunching, number crunching power, and they certainly are, they still can't really begin to explore the true depth and possibility of chess. In fact, it's estimated that we won't have a computer that can really fully explore, form a complete knowledge of chess and all the possible games for thousands more years. So we're still dealing with, computers only looking at pieces of information. And of course, yes, they can look at a lot more moves than we can. The difference, the thing that humans have over computers, that computers, I was going to say will never have, but maybe they someday will. I mean, it's hard to estimate the limits of computers at this point. But humans at this point are still the only beings that have real knowledge and intuition. And so although computers can go through, thousands or millions or even billions of possible moves very, very quickly, it's the human that is going through possible moves and doesn't have to actually be conscious of all the different decisions that are being made, but has this incredible intuition that you build up over experience, which can also work extremely quickly.
So you think that really what the thing that the really great chess players have going for them, and it may indeed be the product of having played many, many games, is as they're sitting across from the opponent, that they see the moves the opponent is making, that that you can actually say, it's in a sense you're saying to yourself, oh, I see what you're going to do here. I know
yeah.
where you're going with this.
There are a lot of things that the truly great chess players have. Part of it is they've actually trained their brain to think a little differently. They've come up with this ability, and this is not something that you can do overnight, but they have actually shifted the resources of their brain so that they're using part of their brain that is usually used just for long-term memory. They're able to put what we think of as short-term or working memory into data into that long-term portion. So they're actually kind of expanding what you might consider the computer RAM of their brains, which is this incredible feat when you think about it. They're also developing, as we've just said, this incredible intuition, which you can only develop over experience, and just it's a lot of pattern recognition. It's seeing things that and making observations over many, many hundreds or thousands of games about combinations, about patterns that work, that go in certain directions. So that although if you stopped, you know, and froze a scene and actually interviewed a grandmaster about what's going on in a game, they could tell you so much, they could certainly articulate part of it. There's a huge part of it that they couldn't articulate, but that their brain actually knows, has all these inklings about whether or not a position looks favorable or unfavorable, and kind of helps guide them very, very quickly to make a possible move.
Has it been almost always the case that people looked at chess as being something that would hone the mind?
It seems to have been a common theme for as long as I could, you know, as long as I could look back in history. It really started to get interesting when Benjamin Franklin took up the game a couple hundred years ago and really could not stop talking about how great a game it was, and also about how it did all these wonderful things for your mind and your character. And he wrote this really terrific essay called The Morals of Chess, which I include the whole thing of in the back of my book. And it turns out that now that we have, you know, studied this over the last several decades with quite a number of studies, it turns out that Benjamin Franklin was really dead on. I mean, it's really amazing how many different qualities of logical thinking chess actually helps particularly a young mind to come into contact with, and then, of course, to improve and improve over time.
Yeah. I learned a lot of really interesting stuff in the book. I guess one of the things that I find interesting is how people have fixed on the chess as something really particularly to help work with kids who come out of disadvantaged circumstances.
Yeah.
and how, you know, kids that you would think maybe didn't really have a potential, or you weren't really sure how to get at the potential, by introducing this to the game, them to this game, it can really make a world of difference in their lives.
Absolutely. I mean, everything we know about how people become successful in the last, you know, that we've learned in the last several decades really comes down to the whether or not we can target a young child and give them something to get excited about intellectually and give them something to be passionate about. And it really doesn't really matter what it is that they're passionate about. If they can become passionate about learning anything, then they can develop this skill and this habit of seeing the world in this curious way. And chess is just just one of the many different ways to do that. But it turns out that it's a particularly good way with kids who are having trouble getting passionate about ideas in a more conventional way in a school setting. And I think that's really why there's just so much going on now with schools and chess. There's really an incredible resurgence, particularly as you say, in disadvantaged schools where they struggle to get kids excited about learning.
So I mentioned at one point here that you really didn't play until you were in high school, and then it was really later, much later, recently, that you kind of got interested in chess again. And you said that you would not say that you were a great player, but are you playing much chess now yourself?
I play fairly often. Let me just say that I'm not only not a great player, I'm not a good player. I would say I'm a okay player, and I could certainly, I really enjoy playing 6 and 7 year olds who've just learned the game, and I can show them how superior I am because I've played more games than them. But when it comes to playing, you know, people in their 20s, 30s, and 40s, you know, if they've played more than a couple of games, it's probably going to be about an even match, and I'm usually more than often I'm going to be humbled and end up losing.
Yeah, well, I think I haven't played in a long, long time, but I'm thinking now back to most of my chess victories. I'm kind of thinking that it was luck. I can't say that this was any part of great skill. Of course, I would have pretended at the time that this was my superior ability here, but I think probably it was just lucky.
Choose an opponent. opponent who really doesn't know what they're doing. But, you know, what I found is that it's just, you don't have to study the game or become great at it to really enjoy just spending time with another person. It's just a great way to form a human connection and take a little break from the busy world and just enjoy, you know, the company of someone else.
Yeah. Well, and going back to the point that we made in the beginning, one of the explanations perhaps for the great popularity of the game over such a long time is that it can be extremely demanding, and unless, of course, you're just lucky. When you win, you can say it's because you outwitted the other person. And it's really all about your skill and the kind of concentration you can apply to it. And that's why you win. It's not some stroke of fate. It's not because the gods have decided that you're going to win. It's not because of a roll of dice. It's because you played a better game than the other person played.
Yeah, it's really up to you. It's not just skill. There's a lot of psychology. There's psyching out the opponent. There's making those grunts at just the right time, and giving those stern faces and getting up from the board and taking an intimidating stretch. So there's lots of things you can do to try to put your opponent at disadvantage, and I'm certainly not above any of them.
All right. Well, the book that we have talked about is The Immortal Game, A History of Chess. The subtitle, How 32 Carved Pieces on a Board Illuminated Our Understanding of War, Art, Science, and the Human Brain. Published by Doubleday. It's a new book. It's now out now by our guest, David Schenck. And Dave, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thanks so much for having me. I enjoyed it.
We really appreciate it.